All right, let's see. Today is March 27th, 2014. This is the follow-up interview with Gabe Javier. We're here in his office, which is inside the LGBT Campus Center, which is inside Red Gym. Gabe, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Gabe Javier, J-A, V as in Victor, I-E-R.
Excellent. Actually, I need to turn this down a touch. And just to let future generations know, there's a little bit of background noise, but we're going to work our way through it. You should be fine. That's it. So Gabe, when we ended last time, you mentioned you wanted to talk a little bit about race. And I'm guessing it means both on campus and in Madison. I don't know how you want to frame that, but however you want to start, and we'll go from there.
Sure, yeah. You know, I think that Madison considers itself one of the, a very liberal-leaning, progressive town, and I think that the campus also probably parts of it considers itself open and inclusive to people across the spectrum of race and race and ethnicity. What I found myself walking into coming to campus was a lot of racial tension in regards to the campus center itself and the campus center's perceived and actual outreach to an inclusion of LGBTQ people of color. 2 years prior to my coming, the campus hosted MumbleTAC, which is MBLGTACC, which is the Midwest LGBT College Conference. And there was an incident a point in time where several people of color, made their discontent and issues known, during a plenary, so there's a backdrop of challenges, again, perceived inability or unwillingness or lack of services towards LGBTQ people of color. So that was sort of the environment that I was introduced to. Not even really introduced, it was sort of something that I, as the incoming director, sort of inherited. And I spent a lot of my sort of first year trying to navigate what that meant. What that meant for me personally as a person of color and personally and professionally as a gay man of color. So that was an interesting situation to sort of face and walk into, trying to reestablish relationships based on the intersections of race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation and gender. So,
Gabe, were you at that MumbleTAC conference?
I was.
Did you reference that last session? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Were you there for that incident, or were you?
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I remember several people of color, students of color, coming and talking to me and talking about the challenges they had with the planning process. And I wasn't here during any of the planning process or the execution of the actual conference, so I really only have the narrative that those students were delivered.
So you talk about navigating that personally and professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Are there examples of when you feel like you either, well, let's start with examples of where you feel like you navigated that and ended up in a positive for either yourself personally or for the campus center?
There's lots of examples where I think that ended up navigating that to the benefit, mutual benefit of the LGBTQ people kind of community and the campus center. Excuse me. I think that when I arrived, there were a lot of people of color who sort of stopped by to greet and welcome me and want to connect with me about their experiences and where they think the campus center's programming could go. And I think that was a positive sort of outcome. Of me trying to navigate those relationships. I think that LGBTQ people of color may not have seen themselves as represented in the center in particular ways. In some ways, yes, but in other ways, no. Mm-hmm. So they, I think that they were able to find a different type of affinity with the center.
Did you then, and I think we may have talked about this last time, did you either take that input or just your knowledge and then being a person of color and try to inject some new stuff into either Welcome Week or events that you did during the year?
Certainly, yeah. So doing some intentional programming with the Multicultural Student Center and outreaches to organizations like the Multicultural Student Coalition. I know it was important for me to connect with organizations like the Filipino American Student Organization because I identify as Filipino. Sorry. You know, at the time there was a QPOC group, a Queer People of Color student organization. So feeling like I had the opportunity to access that.
Were the things that happened, I mean, I'd say early on, but in some ways this sort of is early on here.
Yeah.
Two and a half years. Were there situations where issues came up and you feel like you weren't able to resolve them or they weren't resolved in a way, particularly issues involving race or LGBT people of color?
Well, I think that there were prior relationships and dynamics that existed that I was not a part of the creation of or maintenance of, that, you know, similar to like the whole library thing, right, where I sort of inherited something that was sort of waiting for me to address. I think the center's relationship with queer people of color was like that. Mm-hmm. So I had to both, you know, create something new without erasing or attempting to erase, you know, past challenges or hurts that the center in different manifestations was either actively responsible for or complicit in. So
do you think you were able to use, even in those situations, were you able to use being the new person as a way to try to mitigate those?
Certainly, yeah. I was able to sort of say, like, okay, I'm new, let me please, like, you know, it was a way of asking for patience, knowing that I wouldn't be able to, quote-unquote, fix things very quickly. The other side of that, though, is not knowing, you know, there's multiple sides of the story coming at me, not knowing which was as close to authentic or the truth, or how different people's frameworks and sort of lenses affected that. You know, so certainly both the bane and the boon of having multiple sides of the story is sort of came to head with myself as the director looking at all those sides of the story and filtering through my own sort of hopes and dreams for the center.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for all that. I want to switch gears slightly. First, I wonder, as director, we talked about your student staff, but what sort of interactions do you have with the students who come in or students on campus?
I would say lots of interaction. It ranges from, you know, probably weekly I'll have students who want to come in and talk to a staff member when I happen to be here, or want to talk to me specifically and directly about challenges they might be having with regards to their identity or coming out, or one particular part of the campus that they're trying to navigate that they want to sort of brainstorm around. We get a lot of calls and emails from colleagues across campus saying, hey, I have a student I'd like to introduce you to over email. You know, lots of those situations, I'd say, pretty frequently happen. Mm-hmm. And those sorts of consultations are, again, everywhere from I'm nervous about coming out to my parents, to I had this happen to me in a classroom, to my parents cut me off financially, to I'm interested in thinking about hormone treatment, transition, mm-hmm. so all over the place. So that's one way. Another way is I often give a lot of workshops. So I'm often in front of different sets of students doing mm-hmm. that type of work. I would say that I have a lot of really direct contact with undergrads that aren't our student staff.
Okay. Just to follow up a little bit on those workshops, is that part of a class? Is it for, what are the examples, at least some of the examples of people you'd be giving a workshop for?
Sure. So like last night, we were invited to do a workshop on breaking the binary gender, the binary model of gender. And so that was sponsored by one of the residence hall learning communities. So went to a res hall, did an hour and a half presentation. There were about 15 students there. In a couple weeks, I'm doing an ally training that's health sciences focused. So it'll be at the pharmacy school, and it'll be 3 hours, and it's a LGBTQ ally training curriculum. Sometimes, you know, I've certainly been asked to come and talk to classes on very specific topics as well. So whether it be experiences of people at the intersection of race and sexual orientation, or I've been asked to, every semester I give a presentation on LGBT competent care and addiction and recovery. So it's sort of like all over the place, mm-hmm. Drawing on a vast sort of knowledge and skill set.
Right. What's your, these sound like sometimes distinctly different workshops. Mm-hmm. What sort of information have you gathered and learned to be able to present at these sort of very diverse types of workshops?
So previous trainings that I've had and done, so pretty extensive training around and for trans-identified healthcare and trans access to healthcare. Similarly with just LGBT competent healthcare in general. When I was at Michigan, being able to do a lot of work with their medical school around trans-inclusive policies and trans-inclusive curricula. I used to work in sexual violence prevention, so taking some of what I knew from sexual violence prevention work, as well as some exposure that I've had with the addiction and recovery community, being able to sort of integrate those. And then research and exposure to material and workshops and colleagues who have different areas of specialty, and being able to share that knowledge through professional development and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that when I give these workshops across these different, what might seem like very disparate topics, I think that there's a base of information that continues to be the core, which is around knowledge of LGBTQ identities, proactive ally behavior, and intervening for inclusive climates. Like, those sorts of things are universal. And so then what do we do when we look at that through law enforcement or healthcare or addiction recovery specialists? You know, those lenses are the things that I grow my familiarity in or look at other resources, but that core still is, you know, whether I give a workshop at the pharmacy school or the school of social work, their basic need for knowledge, what they want to know, is basically the same.
So when you actually present a workshop, what is your style, your method? I mean, my style is, you know, PowerPoint, not a lot of interaction is welcome, but it's more somewhat of a lecture. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what sort of style do you use when you try to convey this information?
I try to be as multimodal as possible. So usually do some lecturing, some small group work, some multimedia, so a little bit of sort of everything. Mm-hmm. Always doing things like anonymous Q&A, like if you have index cards, always making sure they have a lot of resources that are passed out. We have a commitment of doing things multimodally because we know that some people react really well to PowerPoint visually and hearing things, while some people, you know, really want to talk things out. Mm-hmm. So we try to make it as accessible as possible.
Mm-hmm. And does it depend a lot on the length? I mean, when you're doing a small workshop, like less than an hour, it's different than when doing a 3-hour or even a full day.
Totally. Yeah, I think that in the opportunities, if they say like, oh, we have like 20 or 30 minutes, and I'm gonna try to hit the highlights and then give a lot of handouts, mm-hmm. you know, or push them to the website or other educational things. Or if it's a short workshop, I might do a clip of something and then have discussions about it. But if it's longer, if I have like a half day, then I definitely would chop it up. Mm-hmm. Trying to do a lot of, you know, with regards to LGBT work, you know, we're finding a lot of people who really value things like role plays. A lot of people are concerned with saying the right things, so giving people the opportunity to wrap their mouths around new practice. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I, as a white heterosexual male, consider myself to be an advocate and ally, but I also know I don't have the language sometimes to be able to.
Sure.
To be that way, so
sometimes I don't have the language, you know, so
it's nice that you give people that space to try to figure that out,
right? And you also framing that none of us are experts and we're all going to mess up. Mm-hmm. Like messing up is inevitable. Mm-hmm. It's the recovery that's sort of, you know, and framing it in terms of like, again, like when we do the ally training, we're talking about skills across identity, but we happen to be looking at ally behavior through the lens of LGBTQ. So we try to make it such that, okay, if you want to be a white anti-racist ally, these are the same sorts of skill sets that you can employ. So, and that's part of our commitment to doing things in an intersectional lens, in a social justice lens. So intersectional, for us, meaning that our movements... there's action across movements because oppressions are connected. So the ways that we're allies to one community translate into our allyhood to another community. And social justice in the sense that we come to an understanding of our ally behavior through an understanding of our own power and privilege. So, and, you know, I don't know if I would call it pedagogically, but, you know, philosophically even, like, we don't really use, or we try not to use, or we try to avoid frameworks of, like, safe space. Because I can't train a space, you know. It's really the people who make any particular given space or interaction safe. And then when we're talking about safe and safety, we're not just talking about physical safety, but more so we're talking about emotional and psychological safety. So a safe space is one where someone can connect with another person to be authentically share the challenges of their lives and find fellowship in community. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't train a room to do that. I can't even train a whole office to do that, but we can help people see how they can carry that space and make it real for people. Mm-hmm. So that's why we often get questions like, well, do you have like a sticker I can put up? Or, you know, and I have to say, you can put whatever sticker up you want, you know. But we have a particular, like, we're moving towards creating a sticker for people who participate in the program. So it's an LGBT ally program, right? Mm-hmm. And so this can indicate that you have participated in the program, and you can have whatever sticker up you want, but we say, like, if someone asks you about the sticker, you should know what it means.
Right.
So
I mean, it's one thing having a sticker up.
Sure. Because the sticker isn't the intervention, right? Mm-hmm. The sticker is, like, showing a movie is not an intervention. You know, it is a vehicle by which an intervention can occur, but it's not the actual intervention. Mm-hmm.
Something else I wanted to ask about that is gone from my brain.
Sorry.
That's right. No, this is great. But I know what I want to ask is you know, understanding that there's truly no such thing as a typical day, what are some of the things that seem to occur in your professional life on a daily basis?
So, you know, if I had to pin down a typical day, you know, I'd come in, I'd check in with the other two staff members, we look at, we sort of do a quick review of what we need to get done for the day, if there's anything out of sorts on the schedule that we need to be aware of. For example, if there was a group coming to visit, or if there is an event that two out of the three of us or all of us need to be out for, you know, as we check our emails in the morning, continuing to check in and see if any of our student staff, if there's any gaps in our student staff coverage. Sort of looking forward a day or two to see what events we have to be prepared for, or prepare materials for. Then for me, I know I spend a chunk of time on email, a chunk of time, at least one or two meetings a day. And then the other parts of my day are often creating content for workshops, or pinning down details and logistics for events. My meetings range from committees that I serve on to consultations with colleagues across any number of different areas. Late nights are not uncommon, so. Mm-hmm.
And you said the center itself is open from 8 to 5 or 9 to 5?
We're open 9 to 5, and then on Tuesdays we have, this semester, we have like staff meetings from 5:30 to 6:30. Because we're a small professional staff, you know, three of us, but so we have a value on including our student staff in our staff meetings. Because so much of what we do is communicated through them. So,
thank you for that. I may have a couple more things to ask about that, but the one thing popped in my head. You talk about building community earlier, and I'm wondering, and you talked the previous time about interacting with specific folks on campus, so my question specifically is, what sort of interaction do you have, or do you have interaction with the Office of Equity and Diversity?
I wish we had more, and I wish it was more formal, but we don't have, I would say, and I would venture to say that they would say the same, we don't have a whole lot of formal connections. Our informal connections, you know, sometimes we ask for co-sponsorship, or we certainly support the events that they do and the work that they are committed to in climate. You know, they have several cohort-based programs like Posse and OMI and First Wave and Chancellor Scholars, and we see a lot of those students involved in our center as well. So there are definitely connections that are, I would say, also based on our relationship or my relationship or people's relationship here in the center with certain people in that division, you know, for example. Like, so oftentimes formal relationships are magnified by personal relationships you might have with someone, right? So I certainly benefit from that as well, or our center benefits from that, certainly.
Do you think that's just a symptom isn't the right word, but it's the only one I can think of as a fact of you all being busy and they all being busy, that there's not a way yet where there's some sort of formal connection that can be made?
Probably. Yeah, I think that there other factors in there is, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, there's a leadership shift right now in that division. You know, there's an interim director right now. And I had a good personal relationship with Damon, who is the previous chief diversity officer. But, you know, and I think that, you know, there is certainly need and opportunity for there to be a more formal relationship. You know, one of the most challenging things about this, the piece of the center's work is that we're at the campus center and we have our central responsibility and mission is to students. And we do direct service for students in lots of ways. We also do direct service to faculty in their service to students. But we aren't positioned or have the capacity to do service for faculty and staff on behalf of faculty and staff. So when faculty and staff seek community, or they seek ways to connect, or they seek information about navigating benefits or healthcare benefits, domestic partner benefits, there's very few places that they can go. They certainly can go to OHR, but I would venture to say that OHR is not necessarily, it's unclear that they have specialized knowledge or be able to, you know, to respond to inquiries in a culturally competent way. I'm not saying that they don't, but it's not clear that they do. Mm-hmm. So in situations like that, if it's not clear that they do, then they probably don't. Right, unless they're saying, like, yes, we do this, then, especially for LGBTQ people, we have to assume not. So, we often get inquiries. We get inquiries and are asked to field situations, and because we're really the only, we are the only center of knowledge and clearinghouse for knowledge for faculty and staff in that way as well. And we don't, I mean, again, we're understaffed for just our student piece of the work. Mm-hmm. You know, my colleagues have talked about, it's sort of like this idea of a pie, right? So we have work that, and our work is this pie. So there's pieces of our work that should be in the pie, but don't fit because we don't have the capacity to do them. Mm-hmm. Training TAs, absolutely within our mission, absolutely a need, but we don't have the capacity and or given the opportunity to access training TAs. And we're saying, and we know that undergrads want us to train TAs, we know that TAs want us to train them, we know that faculty want us to train them, right? So that's something that should be in our pie, but doesn't fit in our pie. Then there's stuff that shouldn't really be in our pie, but we force into our pie, like answering questions about healthcare benefits, or domestic partner benefits, or tax implications, you know, or out-of-state marriages, like really benefits questions that we don't really have a place for that stuff in our pie, but we're still accessed for. Mm-hmm. So it's real, I think, you know, I think, and I'll be the first to say that everyone is overworked and underpaid. And I can only put out there what the facts are. Like, those are just the facts. And I think then it's up to other people to, you know, sort of see what that means. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like some type of, I mean, not only would it be nice to be a more formal relationship with Office of Equity and Diversity, but maybe a formal relationship with the Office of Human Resources and Development.
Sure. Well, and I see that the keepers of climate for the whole campus is equity and diversity. Mm-hmm. Right? And we play a part in that. But unfortunately, this isn't going to be a surprise, nor, you know, I think that for part and partial, when we've talked about diversity, it has been solely recruitment or retention of people of color. So.
Thank you for all that. Do you have anything else you want to?
Mm-mm, nope.
Then I want to come back to a couple of things, and then we'd probably be close to wrapping up.
Oh, okay.
I'm interested in going back to the workshops, but specifically in terms of your training, and specifically, so what sort of out off campus, whether it be national conferences or whatever, are you able to attend and be able to sort of increase your portfolio and knowledge to be able to do these workshops or these one-on-one interactions?
Quite a bit, actually, and you know, I feel blessed and lucky and privileged to have, you know, administration that encourages us to do that. You know, I tend to go to lots of conferences, but my own personal caveat is that I have to be invited to present at them or have accepted presentations at them. So, which has been the case, you know, our professional organization is called the Consortium of LGBT Higher Education Resource Professionals, which we call the Consortium for short. And so it's the network and clearinghouse of information for professionals who do LGBT work based in universities and colleges. And so I used to be the co-chair of that organization, and I'm rolling off the board right now. So been very active in that, and that has afforded me lots of opportunities to present at national conferences. So I tend to present a lot in national regional conferences, and tend to learn a lot and connect with colleagues who are doing work. You know, Wisconsin is really positioned to be a campus that is at the edge of what's new. Like, we are in many ways already, but becoming more and more being a benchmark campus. So when other campuses are looking for places to measure their work against, you know, Wisconsin, and certainly I'm biased, but truly I feel like Wisconsin is one of those places to be benchmarked against. And I think that the evidence of that is that, you know, we have programs like our Crossroads program, which is a program designed to build community for LGBTQ people of color. And what's unique about that program is that it's coming from two freestanding independent centers. So it's a collaboration between the LGBT Campus Center and the Multicultural Student Center, both of which stand on their own. So other places, this work is being done as part of a combined center. So places where the LGBT campus, LGBT work is part of a multicultural center. Mm-hmm. Right? So we have two independent centers. You know, we also have a student staff funded through the McReny Disability Resource Center, whose specific job is to look at access and access along the axis of ability, disability, and sexual orientation and gender. The other thing is, you know, we are, I think, the only campus in the Big Ten that offers, through our university health service, the opportunity for a person who wishes to start hormone treatment, that our campus health center will actually start that treatment for them. So that has not been, you know, that hasn't been in my previous campus or any other campuses that I know. So we are becoming a benchmark campus. More and more. That is not to say that there's, you know, a lion's share of work still to be done, right? But so, you know, I think we see that in the system too. You know, certainly in lots of ways, we're the university and the institution is looked at as the flagship institution in terms of our what we have, right? But I'll say that, you know, some of the smaller institutions can move policy quicker than we can. Right, so I think that in that way, what we've been able to do is help make sure the lines of communications across the dozen or so LGBT campus centers in the UW system is open. So,
when you reference this consortium, and I just jotted it down, was the consortium a larger group, not just system, but
it is. It's across the country. Yeah. Okay. So the consortium represents about the 250 LGBT campus centers in the nation. So there's about 250 centers with about 500 professionals. So what that means is, like, there could be a professional who's not at the center, but who's 50% of their job is doing LGBT work.
So within that consortium, there might be the other LGBT campus centers in the system.
They are. Mm-hmm.
They are.
And then we also have, at the UW system, we have a working relationship with all of the campus centers. So I have very close relationships with my colleagues in Whitewater and Milwaukee and Oshkosh and La Crosse and Stevens Point and River Falls and Parkside. And so
if I may just ask you to elaborate a little bit on that. So what sort of, how do you communicate then, or do you feel you need to communicate with the other system LGBT?
Sure, absolutely. We communicate quite a bit. You know, it could be as simple as, oh, I'm bringing this speaker. Anyone else want to bring them? Let's block book, right? But in a more, in a deeper sense, we talk about things like, how is gender represented on the UW system e-application? Right, because everyone who goes to a UW school fills that out. So how is gender being collected on that application? How does that map to the federal reporting requirements? And how does that map to our specific campus record keeping? Right. So conversations like that have implications statewide, and also the ability for for us to say, oh, Wisconsin's doing it this way, Oshkosh is doing it this way, you know. And that has been the same for things like gender-neutral housing, the ability for someone to indicate a preferred name, are all things that we strategize both within our campuses and also across the system. Another thing is saying, okay, well, where do we have LGBTQ contacts and where don't we? So, you know, we're looking at like, okay, so these major campuses have at least a person or maybe an office, but what about our technical colleges? What about our tribal colleges? You know, who do we know to, because who are those students going wholly unserved? You know, if not, who should we be reaching out to? We regularly do audits of our own centers to see, like, comparing the resources that we all have and saying, like, well, how do we move the needle such that it's a little bit more equity or fairness into what people need? And like I said, just because we're the largest and we're the flagship university and we have resources does not mean that we're moving quicker in policy than other people. It's certainly not the case.
Mm-hmm. And so, anything else you want to say in terms of the conferences that you go to, particularly in terms of how they add value to your work here?
No, I think they add value in a couple of ways in my own professional development and what I'm able to bring back to the center and sort of, you know, and not just through LGBT work. So thinking about, so if I go to a conference on race in the city and higher education, you know, knowing best practices there about, or emerging data-driven practices there about, like intergroup dialogue helps me look at my work in a particular way. So I take that material and say, how does it apply to our work, which I think is innovative, you know. And as far as much as I'm sort of invited to present at these things, it's a way to get our unit and our division out there. You know, I think that it, and I think that my bosses see it that way too, that it's sort of adding prestige to the Wisconsin name. And I think that it also fits within the sort of the ethos of the Wisconsin idea,
mm-hmm.
you know, so.
Two more things,
mm.
or maybe just one.
Yeah.
I think this builds on or connects to your professional development. So, as a leader of a campus center with staff, are there ways you try to foster their professional development, whether it be the actual staff or the students, in terms of trying to get them involved or trying to get them to things where they can increase their skill set too?
Absolutely, yeah. you know, I'll start with students. I think that we've done great pains to make sure that students are able to translate the work that they're doing here to other parts of their life and other skill sets. It's just important that they understand the applicability of the things that they do here in other parts of their life. 'Cause we want to place them. We want to do what the college wants to do writ large, which is to place them successfully as alums. So, and we also want to do that vis-a-vis their identities and their wanting them to, encouraging them to work for justice, right? So, in that vein, you know, I referenced the Midwest LGBT College Conference, right? So we send a lot of students there. We have programming specifically around developing leadership skills vis-a-vis their identity. A lot of programming around growing their self-awareness and emotional intelligence, making them good professionals in that sense. As far as the professional staff, as much as we can, or as much as I can, encouraging them both regionally and nationally to submit programs about our work and being as supportive as we can to getting them there into those places.
I may have just cut across you there, I'm sorry. So, as with your caveat that you'll go somewhere if you've either been asked to present or presentations have been accepted, it sounds like for your professional staff, you want them to sort of think of it the same way. You may get to go, but you're going to get to go if you
Right.
For if you, you know, submit a proposal that's accepted.
Right, and sometimes they're not, like, at least submit, mm-hmm. right? At least submit and get to learn how that is. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to overload myself with conferences. So, like, when I go to the Creating Change, is our professional development, our, the LGBT, the consortium conference is called Creating Change. It's a grassroots organizing conference. I tend to be very busy during those. So I tend to do a half-day institute, a three-hour session, and a 90-minute session. So I overload myself, right? I'm like, don't do that. But, you know, at least submit. And if you're not accepted, then you're not accepted. But point to things that you think will supplement your work. And I think that what's really great about how, one of the many great things about how our professional staff is sort of assembled right now is, you know, my assistant director, Catherine, their master's degrees are in library science and general women's studies. So they do not come from a higher education background. So we just went to a higher education conference together and they gained a whole lot of knowledge and new practice and praxis mm-hmm. around higher education. Mm-hmm. You know, Shel Trace, who's our Crossroads coordinator or social justice educator, you know, she's a PhD candidate in higher education. So a lot of her work, you know, looking at the retention of faculty of color, you know, there's still applicability there in terms of outreach and building community among minoritized populations, when it comes to the system of higher education, and then specifically looking at the opportunities for people of color and their resilience, I think, again, are things that we can take and apply the LGBT campus-centric lens to them.
And so at this point, you're 3 professional staff?
We're technically 2.65.
Okay.
Because we share the Shel Trace's position with the Multicultural Student Center.
And there's obviously room for growth, I assume, but is there, do you foresee growth in the future in terms of adding professional staff?
I mean, I would love to. I don't know. I mean, Shel Trace's position is, you know, I think, you know, what I'll say is the current makeup of this staff is still very young. It's younger than I've been here. And I've only been here 2.75 years or something mm-hmm. like that, right? So, and the other challenge is that we're basically landlocked, right? So there's literally no other, I mean, if we were to build more space or more cubicles into the center, we would begin to cut into the feel of the center. Mm-hmm. You know, the center is an open space. You know, I'm sure we'll open the door and there'll be lots of people out there hanging out, doing homework, you know, mm-hmm. or just, you know, being in community. And the more we build offices into that space, the more of that physical space we chip away, which is a concern. Mm-hmm. You know, so
it's balancing the reality that money's tight in terms of getting full-time people, but also the fact that another body would have practical, and a practical effect.
We have,
how
we
it
have
looks.
Actual challenges about where to actually put people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
it's a great metaphorical, I think, sort of metaphorical, rhetorical vehicle to say that we don't know what space is there for us. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. we literally don't have enough space, or we need to create our own space, or we're not, you know. So I think that's, it's interesting. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And we do our education, sorry, and our ally training, you know, we do it. You know, one of the things that I make sure to hit when I say the ally training, do the ally training, is that our allies help us extend our reach beyond our grasp. We can literally only be so many places. And we also know that there's no way that every LGBTQ student is going to walk through the doors of the Red Gym, but they walk through someone's doors. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that we're able to reach that someone, and that someone can reach back. So we really see our ally program as creating this web of support across campus where people who need support can be bridged, the support that can help them. And we see that. We actually do see that. We see a lot of referrals. You know, people, and, you know, I'm lucky that we have colleagues across campus who say, like, yeah, this is a back pocket resource that we trust and we know and can refer to.
Gabe, I want to wrap it up for today. I know we have an hour, but I have somewhere to go.
Yeah.
But I want to, I do have some space here, so I want to make sure if there's anything on your mind about what you've been talking about, if you want to make sure it gets on the record, or if you want to, if there's something I haven't asked, let's get at least the idea that I need to, there's some, still some things I need to ask before our next session.
No, I mean, there's any number of things, right? But I think that, you know, this is pretty good. I think there continues to be challenges about being, you know, I've heard challenges with people who are LGBTQ who work here, who happen to work in a state that that can be seen as unfriendly to LGBTQ people.
And I think, and I just cut across you again there, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But I think that's probably a good place to start next time.
Sure.
Let's build Al from campus and let's talk about you being here, you and you know, your staff and students being in Wisconsin in 2014.
Totally. Yeah, and I think the other...
And what that means.
Yeah, I think that'd be good, and I think the other piece would maybe to talk about, like, forecasting, like, what's... What do we see as next in the field of higher education LGBT work, and where we are as Wisconsin on that. I think it's interesting.
Okay. Well, Gabe, I want to thank you for your time today.
Yeah, totally.
It.